constricted. Her hands clenched into fists. Such was not for the likes of her. "I kiss dozens of people every night," she told Ferrell earlier that evening. "That's not kissing," he'd said, and he was right. Kissing was not what Sarai did to humans in their sleep. In fact, everything up to this point was preamble. The flight from the Citadel, the squeezing down chimneys and perching on brows. Sight and feel, smell, taste and touch. They were just the threshold of her gift. Here was the fullness of it. When a moth made contact with a person, Sarai could step inside their dreams as easily as stepping through a door. And once she was there, she could do as she pleased. Their minds lay open to her, or at least the surfaces did, and whatever bubbled up from beneath to paint them in streams of imagery, sensation, and emotion, endlessly combining and recombining in the ceaseless effort at making sense, at making self. For what was a person but the sum of all the scraps of their memory and experience? A finite set of components with an infinite array of expressions. When a moth perched on a sleeper's brow, Sarai was plunged into their dream. What the dreamer was experiencing, she experienced, and not as some hapless spectator. As soon as she entered, an invisible marauder, unseen and unfelt, the dream was hers to control. In the realm of the real, she might have been just a girl, in hiding and in peril. But in the unconscious mind, she was all-powerful. Sorceress and storyteller, puppeteer and dark enthraller. Sarai was the muse of nightmares. Minya had given her the name, and the purpose that went with it. Minya had made her what she was.
"We need that, Sarai,"
the little girl had said.
"For vengeance."
And Sarai had become the weapon Minya wanted her to be, and punished humans in the only way she could, through their dreams. Fear was her medium, and nightmares her art. Every night for years she had tormented the sleepers of Weep.
"Did you make anyone cry?"
Minya would ask her in the morning.
"Did you make anyone scream?"
The answer was always, yes. For a long time, this new, exciting thing had been the focus of their lives. The other four would come to her room at dawn to crowd into her bed with her as soon as her moths returned, and she would tell them everything. What and who she had seen, what the homes were like in the city, what the people were like. Minya just wanted to know about the nightmares, but the others were more interested in Weep itself. She would tell them about parents who came to comfort their children when nightmares woke them, and they would all go still and quiet, listening with a terrible intensity. There was always, among them, such a stew of envy and longing. They hated the humans, but they also wanted to be them. They wanted to punish them. They wanted to be embraced by them, to be accepted, honored, loved, like someone's child. And since they couldn't have any of it, it all took the form of spite. Anyone who has ever been excluded can understand what they felt. No one has ever been quite so excluded as they. So they layered cynicism atop their longing, and it was something like laying laughter over the darkness. Self-preservation of an uglier stripe. And thus did they harden themselves, by choosing to meet hate with hate. Sarai settled a moth on Hava, Ariel's sister, and on other sleepers in other houses. All across the city, she sank into the dreams of Weep. Most were mundane. The minds wrote bookkeeping. Some dreams stood out. One man was dancing with his neighbor's wife. An old woman was hunting a rabbit with nothing but a demon glass knife. A pregnant woman imagined her baby born blue, and hoped it were the blue of death sooner than the blue of gods. Hava dreamed of her brother. Two children played in a courtyard. It was a simple snippet of memory. There was a dead tree, and Ariel was holding Haver on his shoulders so she could hang paper flowers on its branches. Like most of the trees in Weep, it would never bloom again. They were playing that it was still alive. Sarai stood by, invisible to them. Even if she'd wanted them to see her, they wouldn't. This was the limit of her gift as she knew it from long experience. In the early days, she tried everything to catch their attention. She'd hollered and hissed and they never heard her, pinched them and they never felt her. In the dreams of others, she was as a ghost, fated to never be seen. She was used to it now. She watched the two children decorate the dead branches with paper flowers, and wondered if that was the most that Weep could ever hope for, a pretense of life. Wasn't that what she had too? What was she doing here, in this home, in this dream? If she were trying to earn Minya's praise, she wouldn't hold back, but would use Haver's tenderness and grief against her. Sarai had an arsenal of terrors. She was an arsenal of terrors. All these years she'd been collecting them, and where could she keep them but within herself? She felt them at the core of her, every image and scene of fright and foreboding, of shame, shock and misery, of bloodshed and agony. It was why she dared no longer dream. Because in her own sleep, she was like any dreamer, at the mercy of her unconscious. When she fell asleep, she was no sorceress or dark enthraller, but just a sleeping girl with no control over the terrors within her. When she was younger, she wouldn't have hesitated to plague Haver with dread visions of her dead brother. She might have had him die 100 new ways, each more gruesome than the last, or else she might have made the little boy in this sweet memory into a ravenous undead thing who would hurl his sister to the ground and sink his teeth into her scalp as she woke screaming. Once upon a time, Sarai would have imagined Minya's delight and done her worst. Not anymore. Tonight, she imagined Haver's delight and did her best. Channeling Sparrow, a sweet orchid witch, she willed the dead tree back to life and watched it set forth leaf and bud while the two memory children danced around it, laughing. In the real room, where the girl was slouched in a chair beside her dead brother's body, her lips curved into a soft smile. The moth left her brow, and Sarai left the dream and flew back out into the night. It's funny how you can go years seeing only what you choose to see, and picking your outrage like you pick out a slip, leaving all the others hanging on their slim Mazarthium dowel. If outrage were a slip, then for years Sarai had worn only the one, the carnage. How well she knew it from dreams. Over and over she'd seen it play out in the minds of the men who'd done it, Errol Fane's most of all. Knife shine and spreading blood. The Ellens dead on the floor so the men who'd slain them had to step over their bodies. The terror and pleading of little girls and boys old enough to understand what was happening. The wail and lamb bleat of babies too small to know, but infected by the terror of the others. All those screams, subtracted one by one, as though silence were the goal. And the goal was achieved. Nearly 30 voices were subtracted from the world that day, not even counting the 6 gods or the dozen humans who, like the Ellens, had gotten in the way. If it weren't for Minya, then Sarai and Feral, Ruby and Sparrow, would have been 4 more small bodies in the nursery that day. The humans had done that. They had slaughtered babies. It was no surprise that Sarai had become the muse of nightmares, a vengeful goddess to haunt their dreams. But, as she had told Feral, she'd spent her vengeance years ago. The wretched thing, and the thing she never dared talk about, was that in order to exploit the humans' fears, she'd had to dwell in them. And you couldn't do that for 4,000 nights without coming to understand, in spite of yourself, that the humans were survivors too. The gods had been monsters, and had deserved to die. But their children didn't. Not then, and not now. The citadel was their prison, and it was their sanctuary. But for how much longer could it be either? No matter how well they obeyed the rule, someday the humans would come. If the horror of Minya's fresh-caught ghosts told them anything, it was that the people of Weep would do again what they had done before. And how could they hope to defend themselves? Moths and clouds and flowers and fire and ghosts. They weren't powerless, but Sarai had no delusions. They couldn't survive a second carnage. Their only hope was in not being found. She paced on her terrace, back and forth beneath the moon, while down in the city, her moths went from house to house like bees from flower to flower. Her consciousness was a subtle instrument. It could divide evenly among her 100 sentinels, or shift between them in any configuration, honing in where attention was required, and receding where it wasn't. Every moment her perception was shifting. She had to react on a wing's edge, trust her instincts, carom through the city, dipping in and out of mines, spin 100 moths through their wild dance, twist dreams and sharpen them, harry gods and beasts down the paths of the unconscious. And always, always, whatever else she did, whatever fears she deployed, to each she attached a sneak postscript. Like devastating news at the end of a letter, it was always the same. Every nightmare that shook every sleeper in Weep carried the same subliminal warning. It was a nameless horror of the citadel and all it contained. This was the work she set herself. To weave through all the dreams of Weep, a dread so potent that none could bear to look at the citadel, much less go near it. So far, it had been enough. The night felt very long, but it ended as all nights do, and Sarai called her moths home. She stopped her pacing and waited. They winged through the last gleams of starlight, reforming into their siphon of whirling wings, and she opened her mouth and took them back in. In the beginning, the return had been even worse than the exodus. That first time, she hadn't managed it at all. She just couldn't open her mouth to them, and had had to watch them turn to smoke when the sun rose. She'd been mute all day, as though her voice had turned to smoke with them. Come nightfall, though, she'd felt the burgeoning again, as the whole cycle began anew. And she'd learned that if she wished to be able to speak, she'd better open her mouth and let the moths back in.
"Who would ever want to kiss a girl who eats moths?"
Ruby had once asked her in a spirit of commiseration. And Sarai had thought then, as she did now, that kissing wasn't a problem likely to arise for her. But she didn't eat the moths in any case. There was nothing to choke down, no creatures to swallow. Just the feather-soft brush of wings against her lips as they melted back into her, leaving an aftertaste of salt and soot. Salt from tears, soot from chimneys. And Sarai was whole again, whole and weary. She'd hardly stepped back inside when Les Ellen entered, carrying her morning tray. This held her lull in a small crystal vial, with a dish of plums to cut the bitterness.
"Good morning, lovely,"
said the ghost.
"Good morning, sweet,"
replied Sarai. And she reached for her lull and downed her grey oblivion. Chapter 18. The Fused Bones of Slaughtered Demons. For all his fanciful storytelling and talk of open minds, what had Laszlo really expected to find as the caravan approached the cusp? A fissured cliff face of weather-riven marble. Rock that looked enough like bones to spawn a myth, with a boulder here and there in the rough shape of a skull. That was not what he found.
"They're really bones,"
he said to Errol Fane, and tried to read confirmation in the hero's expression. But Errol Fane only gave a ghost of a smile, and maintained the silence that he'd carried with him all day.
"They're really Bones.
Laszlo said again, faintly to himself. That over there. That wasn't a boulder that looked like a skull. It was a skull. And there were hundreds of them. No. There had to be thousands in all this vast white mass, of which hundreds were visible just from the track. Teeth in the jaws, sharp as any Hreshtek. And in the great eye sockets, just as he had said, carrion bird nests. They were strange and shaggy affairs, woven out of stolen things. Dropped ribbons and hanks of hair, fringe torn off shawls, and even shed feathers. The birds themselves swooped and cried, weaving in and out of immense curved ridges that could only be spines, segmented and spurred, and, unmistakably, giant hands, giant feet. Tapering carpals as long as a man's arm, knuckle bones like fists. They were melted, they were fused. The skulls were warped, like candles left too near the fire, so that none held the same shape. But they held shape enough. These had been living creatures once. Though not generally given to gloating, he would have liked to see the other Ferengi's faces just now, Thion's in particular. But the golden godson was stuck on a camel, farther back in the caravan, and Laszlo had to be content with echoing exclamations from Calixte, who was given to gloating.
"Hey, Todd, am I really seeing this?"
he heard her call.
"Or am I lost in my vast credulity?"
And a moment later,
"What are you doing here, Todd? Don't you know it's rude to wander about in someone else's credulity?"
And then,
"Is this fact or reason I'm encountering? Wait, no. It's more demon bones."
He suspected she wouldn't soon tire of the joke.
"You're surprised," Errol Fane remarked to Laszlo. "The way you talked last night, I thought you knew."
"Knew?
No, I thought... I don't know what I thought. I thought that even if it were true, it wouldn't be so obviously true."
It was strikingly obvious, and somehow too big to fit into his mind, like trying to cram the actual cusp into his own small skull. It wasn't every day you got proof of myth, but if this wasn't proof, he didn't know what was.
"The Seraphim," he asked Errol Fane, "were they real too?" "Is there proof, do you mean?" Errol Fane asked. "Nothing like this, but then... they didn't die here, so they couldn't have left bones. The Thakranexit has always been proof enough for us."
The Thakranexit was the epic of the Seraphim. Laszlo had found a few passages over the years, though the poem in its entirety had never found its way to Zosma. Hearing the reverence of Errol Fane's tone, he understood that it was a holy text.
"You worship them?"
"We do. I hope I didn't offend you with my theory." "Not at all," said Errol Fane. "I enjoyed it."
They continued riding. Dazzled, Laszlo took in the extraordinary formations around him.
"That one was a juvenile," he said,
pointing to a skull smaller than the rest.
"That's a baby demon skull. And this is a mountain of melted demon bones. And I'm riding over it on a spectral."
He stroked Lyxa's long white ears, and she whickered, and he murmured sweet things to her before continuing.
"I am riding over the funeral pyre of the EG with the Godslayer, whose secretary I am."
Errol Fane's ghost of a smile became somewhat less ghostly.
"Are you narrating?" he asked, amused. "I should be,"
Laszlo said, and began to, in a dramatic voice.
"The cusp, which had looked low on the horizon, was formidable at close range, and it took the caravan several hours to climb the switchback track to Fort Mizrach. It was the only way through. It was also the place where, for centuries, Ferengi had been drawn and quartered and fed to the Syrahs.
Laszlo Strange looked to the sky.
Here, Laszlo paused to look to the sky.
Where the foul birds circled, screeching and crying, and all but tying dinner napkins around their foul, sloped throats. And he wondered, with a frisson of concern, was it possible he'd been brought so far just to serve as food for the carrion-eaters?
Errol Fane laughed, and Laszlo counted it a small victory. A kind of grimness had been growing on the Godslayer the nearer they drew to their destination. Laszlo couldn't understand it. Shouldn't he be eager to get home?
A frisson of concern,
repeated Errol Fane, cocking an eyebrow. Laszlo gestured to the birds.
They are ominously glad to see us. I suppose I might as well tell you. Due to a shortfall in Ferengi adventurers, the Syrahs were becoming malnourished. It was deemed necessary to lure some travelers here to make up the lack. After all, the birds must eat. Damn! If only you'd told me sooner, I'd have put it in Calixte's book. Then I could have used the prize money to bribe the executioners. Too late now, said Errol Fane with regret. We're here.
And here, indeed, they were. The fortress gates loomed before them. Helmed Tysakane drew them open, welcoming their leader and comrades home with solemn gladness. Laszlo they regarded with curiosity, and the rest of the strangers as well, once their camels had been brought through the gates into the central plaza of the fortress. It was sliced right into the rock, or rather into the melted, heat-rendered bones, which rose in high walls on either side, keeping the sky at a distance. Barracks and stables lined the walls, and there were troughs and a fountain, the first unrationed water they had seen for 2 months. Dead ahead at some 20 meters was another gate. The way through, Laszlo thought, and he almost couldn't process it.
The moment you see the city, Errol Fane had said, you will understand what this is about.
What could it be that would be clear at a glance? He dismounted and led Lixer to a trough, then turned to the fountain and scooped water over his head with both hands. The feel of it, cold and sharp, soaking to his scalp and rushing down his neck, was unimaginably good. The next scoop was for drinking, and the next, and the next. After that, scrubbing his face, digging his fingertips into the itchy growth of unaccustomed beard. Now that they were nearly arrived, he allowed himself a brief daydream of comfort. Not luxury, which was beyond his ken, but simple comfort. A wash, a shave, a meal, a bed. He would buy some clothes with his wages as soon as he had the chance. He'd never done that before, and didn't know the first thing about it, but supposed he'd figure it out. What did one wear, when one might wear anything? Nothing grey, he thought, and remembered the sense of finality he'd felt throwing away his librarian's robes after joining Errol Fane. And the regret, too. He had loved the library, and had felt, as a boy, as though it had a kind of sentience, and perhaps loved him back. But even if it was just walls and a roof with papers inside, it had bewitched him, and drawn him in, and given him everything he needed to become himself. Would he ever see it again, or old Master Hurricane? Though it had been only half a year, the great library had become memory, as though his mind had sorted his 7 years there and archived them into a more distant past. Whatever happened here, Laszlo knew that that part of his life was over. He had crossed continents and drunk starlight from rivers without names. There was no going back from that.
Strange!
Cried Calixte, springing toward him in her dancing way. Her eyes were alight as she grabbed his shoulders with both hands and shook him.
Bones! Strange! Isn't it ghoulish?
Her tone made clear that she meant good ghoulish, if there were such a thing. Laszlo didn't think there was. However you looked at it, Whatever the Aegi had been, and whatever had killed them, angels or not, this mound of bones was an epic mass grave. But there would be time for pondering the implications later. For now, he allowed himself wonder. Calixte thrust a cupped hand at him.
Here. I knew you'd be too virtuous to do it yourself.
Curious, he put out his hand, and she dropped a sharp, curved fragment of glittering white glass onto it.
It's a cuspid,
she said, beaming. An Aegi tooth.
You broke this off,
he marveled. She'd have had to dismount, perhaps even climb.
Well, no one said not to deface the mountain.
Laszlo shook his head, smiling, and thought how, if he hadn't heard the rumor in Syriza, if he hadn't mentioned it to Errol Fane, Calixte might still be in jail, if she was even still alive.
Thank you, he said, closing his hand around the tooth.
It was the first gift he had ever been given. There was a small meal waiting for them, simple fare but exquisite for being fresh. Soft, salty bread and white cheese, slices of spiced meat, and quarters of some big, globed fruit that tasted of sugared rain. No one spoke, and there were, for the moment, no divisions among them. Rich or poor, outsider or native, scholar or secretary. Never mind that Thion Nero had grown up on delicacies, and Laszlo Strange on crusts. Neither had ever enjoyed a meal more.
Hey, Todd,
said Calixte, around a mouthful of bread.
Are we still in my credulity? Because if we are, you owe me for this meal.
Okay, maybe some divisions persisted. The Syrahs continued to circle, squalling their ravenous chorus, and their ranks were disrupted once more, as they had been yesterday, by the passage of a message falcon. Half their size, it dove through the scribble of their ragged, stinking wings, driving them back with its piercing cry. Errol Fane held up his arm, and the bird spiraled an elegant descent, luffed into the wind, and landed. The Godslayer retrieved the message and read it. And when he looked up from the page, he sought out Laszlo, first with his eyes, then with his feet.
News?
Asked Laszlo as he approached.
What's this?
He held up the message.
More like orders.
Orders? From whom? A commander? A governor?
I thought you gave the orders.
Errol Fane laughed.
Not to my mother, he said.
Laszlo blinked. Of every improbability packed into that moment, this struck him the most forcefully. He had crossed the Almuthaleth at the Godslayer's side, and now carried, in his pocket, the tooth of a creature from the world's oldest myth. But myth was the ordinary terrain of his mind, whereas it had never occurred to him that the Godslayer might have a mother. Because he was a hero. Because he seemed cast from bronze, not born like a mortal man. Because Laszlo, lacking one himself, tended to forget about mothers. It occurred to him that he might not ever have met one, or at least never exchanged more than a word or two with one. It hardly seemed possible, but there it was.
She's looking forward to meeting you, said Errol Fane.
Laszlo looked at him, blank.
Me, he said. But how could she know?
He trailed off, a lump forming in his throat. The Godslayer had a mother waiting for him in Weep. He had sent her word of his imminent arrival, and in his note he had seen fit to mention Laszlo.
You'll stay with her when you reach the city.
Oh, said Laszlo, surprised. The Ferengi were to be hosted at the Merchants Guild Hall. He had assumed he would be too.
She insists, I'm afraid. I hope you don't mind. It won't be as grand as the guild. Comfortable, though.
And Laszlo hardly knew what was more extraordinary. That Errol Fane was subject to his mother's insistence,
or that he imagined Laszlo might mind.
"No," he said. "Comfortable is good."
Those were the words his mind served up to him. Comfortable is good.
"Wait."
Errol Fane's word choice struck him.
"You said when I reach the city. Aren't you coming?"
"Not tonight."
"What? Why?"
Errol Fane looked weary. The vitality that usually radiated from him was all but gone. Averting his eyes as though ashamed, he said,
"I don't sleep well in Weep."
It was the only time Laszlo had heard him use that name, and it chilled him.
"So, you see," said Errol Fane, trying to smile, "I'm offering you up to my mother as proxy. I hope you can endure a fuss. She's had no one to look after for some time, so I expect she'll make the most of it."
"It will be the first fuss I have ever endured," said Laszlo,
hearing something raw in his voice that could not be put down to a dry throat.
"But I imagine I'll do all right."
The Godslayer smiled, eyes warm and crinkling, and reached out to thump him on the shoulder. And Laszlo, who lacked not only a mother but a father too, thought that having one might feel something like this.
"Well then," said the great man, "here we are."
He looked across to the far gate and seemed to steel himself.
"Are you ready?"
Laszlo nodded.
"Then let's go."
Chapter 19. The Shadow of Our Dark Time.
Errol Fane led the party to the far gate. He didn't go through it, but turned his spectral around to face them. He didn't speak at once. There was a weight to his silence. There was tension and resignation in his face, even a hint of dread.
200 years ago, there was a storm.
He paused. They all hung on the word storm. The twin metallurgists exchanged a hopeful glance, because one of their theories had involved a hurricane.
"It wasn't like other storms,"
Errol Fane continued.
"There was no rain, only wind and lightning. And the lightning was like nothing that had come before. It was directly above the city, furious. It formed a sphere, as though some great hands had skimmed the sky and gathered a world's worth of lightning into a ball."
He acted this out, his great shoulders bunching as his hands dragged the specter of lightning and shaped it and held it.
"It stopped." He dropped his hands. "The night fell dark. There was no moon, no stars. The people could see nothing, but they felt a change in the atmosphere, a pressure. And when the sun rose, they saw why. As you will see."
And with that, he turned his mount and led them through the gate. The path was carved deep through the demon glass and narrow, so that they had to go in single file. It curved and rose, gradually widening. Onward and upward they rode. The sky grew larger, a deep and cloudless blue. And then, quite suddenly, they came to an edge, and it was all before them. The Al-Mutaleth had been high desert plateau, flat and sere. On this side of the cusp, the world fell away into a deep canyon. It was long and curving, carved by a river. Such a river as made the Ader look like a dribble, its catastrophic rush audible even from here. But no amazement could be spared for a river, no matter how epic. There just wasn't enough amazement in the world.
"The shadow of our dark time still haunts us,"
the Godslayer had said. And Laszlo had fixed on dark time, and he wondered at the word haunts, but he had never thought to consider shadow. It was a literal shadow. There was the city, fabled Weep, unseen no longer. And the day was bright, but it lay dark. Laszlo felt as though the top of his head were open, and the universe had dropped a lit match in. He understood in that moment that he was smaller than he had ever known, and the realm of the unknowable was bigger, so much bigger, because there could be no question. That which cast weep in shadow was not of this world.
"Strange," said Calixte,
and she didn't mean the adjective strange, which fell immensely short of the sight before them. No, she was addressing Laszlo. She weighed the theory purse on her palm and said, in a bright, stunned whisper,
"I think you win."
Chapter 20 Dead Man's News. There were ghosts in the room. Sarai heard them whispering before she opened her eyes, and the golden daylight wavered. Light, shadow, light, shadow, as they moved back and forth between the window and her bed. At first, she thought it must be Les Ellen, along with perhaps Awis and Faisie, the chambermaids, and she felt a flicker of annoyance that they had entered unbidden. It wasn't time yet to wake. She could feel it in the heaviness of her limbs and eyelids. The lull had not yet spent its thick grey spell. The whispers sharpened.
"The hearts. Go for the hearts." "Not the hearts. You might hit a rib. The throat's better." "Here, let me."
Sarai's eyes flew open. It was not Les Ellen or Awis or Faisie or any of the servants. It was a cluster of old women, and they startled and skittered back from the bedside, clinging together.
"It's awake!"
one of them cried.
"Do it now!"
shrieked another. And before Sarai could process what was happening, one of the ghosts lunged toward her and raised a knife, her face savage with hate and intent, and Sarai couldn't get out of the way. She just couldn't move fast enough, not through the lull fog. The knife blade flashed, and all her borrowed memories of the carnage came spilling out. Knife shine and baby screaming. And she was screaming. And the old women were screaming. But not the one with the knife. She was sobbing with rage, and the knife was still upraised, her arm trembling wildly as it fought to complete the arc it had begun and bring the blade down on Sarai's throat.
I can't!
She keened with pure frustration. Tears streaked her face. She tried with all her will, but her arm would not obey her, and the knife fell from her grip to embed itself tip down in the mattress, just beside Sarai's hip. Sarai was able to move then, finally. She rolled to her knees and backed away from the ghosts. Her heartbeats churned within her, sending trills of panic coursing through her body, even though she knew she was safe. The ghosts couldn't hurt her. It was the first imperative of Minya's binding, that the dead not harm the living. These ghosts didn't know that, though. The one who had come forth was distraught. Sarai knew her, and hadn't known she'd died. Her name was Yazaleth, and her story was that of most of the women of her generation, and all the generations born and raised under Mazathim rule, when Scathis went riding Rasalas, his great metal beast, and plucked girls and boys from their homes. What happened up in the citadel, none ever told. Before they returned, Letha saw to them. Letha, goddess of oblivion, mistress of forgetting. She could blank a mind with a blink of her eye, and did, stealing whole years from the girls and boys of the city, so that when Scathis brought them back, they had no recollection of their time with the gods. Their bodies, however, bore traces that could not so easily be erased, for more had been stolen from them than their memories. Yazaleth's eyes now were wet and red, her hair as white and weightless as a puff of smoke. She was shaking violently, her breath coming in little snatches, and when she spoke, her voice was as rough as the strike of a match.
"Why?"
she demanded.
"Why can't I kill you?"
And Sarai, confronted with a would-be murderer in the person of an old dead woman, didn't feel anger. Not at her, anyway. Minya was another story. What were new ghosts doing wandering the citadel?
It's not your fault, she said, almost gently. But you can't hurt me.
Then you should hurt yourself,
hissed Yazaleth, pointing to the knife.
Put weep out of its misery. Kill yourself, girl. Have mercy on us all. Do it. Do it.
And then they were all hissing it, crowding in, pushing back the curtains of Izogol's big bed to encircle Sarai on all sides.
Do it,
they urged her.
Have some decency. Do it.
There was savage glee in their eyes, and she knew them all. And she didn't understand how they could be here, because none of them were dead. And her panic surged and swelled as she watched her own hand reach out for the knife. Her first thought was that she was dead, and Minya was making her do it, because she couldn't stop herself. Her hand closed around the hilt and pulled it free from the bedding. Where the blade had been, up from the small slash in the fabric, blood pulsed in arterial spurts. And even that mad unreality failed to bring her to her senses. Beds might bleed. She was too steeped in the landscape of nightmare even to question it. Her hand turned itself, positioning the dagger point against her breast, and she searched the jeering faces of the old women of Weep, finding no end to them. Where there had been five or six, now there were dozens, their faces thrust up against the gauzy bed curtains so that their mouths and eye sockets looked like black pits. And even then, the thing that struck her wasn't their faces, but the curtains. What was she doing in her mother's bed? That was her last thought, before she plunged the knife into her own heart and sat upright with a great raw gasp to find herself in her proper bed, alone. No ghosts, no knife, no blood, no breath either. There seemed no end to the gasp. She was choking on it and couldn't exhale. Her hands were claws, every muscle rigid, a scream caught in her skull, scouring out all thought. On and on it all went, until she thought she'd die of the simple failure to breathe. And then at last the gasp let her go, and she doubled over, coughing out air as her body remembered what to do. She was long minutes curled around herself, just breathing, her throat raw, eyes squeezed shut, before she could even face the truth. She'd had a dream. She started to tremble uncontrollably. A dream had gotten through.
Oh, no,
she whispered, and curled up tighter as she grappled with what this meant.
Oh, no.
The lull was supposed to keep her from dreaming. Had she forgotten to drink it? No. She could still taste its bitterness on the back of her tongue. Then how had she dreamed? She thought back to the time before lull, and the onslaught of nightmares that had prompted Great Ellen to start brewing it for her. It had felt then like being hunted by all the terrors she had collected over the years. Her entire arsenal turned against her. That was what the creeping grey nothing protected her from, or was supposed to. Eventually she got out of bed. She'd have liked a bath, but that would mean going to the rain room and filling the tub, then calling for Ruby to heat it, and that was more trouble than she could face. So she poured out cold water from her pitcher and washed with that. She brushed and braided her hair, and changed into a fresh slip, all before emerging into the main chamber, where her mother's big bed stood untouched, its hangings free of ghost women and their haggard faces. Still, she shuddered and hurried past it, out through her door curtain and down the corridor, where she met Les Ellen, bringing her afternoon tray. This held tea, not true tea, which they'd run out of long ago, but a herbal infusion to shake off the lull, and biscuits,
since Sarai always slept through lunch.
"You're up early,"
said the ghost, surprised, and Sarai strove to conceal her distress.
"I don't know that I'd call afternoon early,"
she said with a frail smile.
"Well, early for you. Did something wake you?" "Is that my tea?"
Sarai asked, evading the question, and she took her cup from the tray in Les Ellen's hands and filled it from the little teapot. The scent of mint filled the air.
"Thank you, Ellen,"
she said, and carried the cup with her on her way, leaving the ghost, bewildered, behind her. She bypassed the gallery and headed instead to the kitchen to talk to Great Ellen, whom she asked, in strict confidence, if it were possible to strengthen her lull.
"Strengthen it?"
repeated the woman, eyes going wide, then narrow.
"What's happened?"
she demanded.
"Nothing's happened,"
Sarai lied.
"I just worry that it might become less effective over time."
And she had worried about that, but it hadn't become less effective over time. It had stopped working overnight, and that wasn't something she was prepared to deal with.
"Well, has it? Don't fib to me. You know I can tell."
Her voice was stern, and as Sarai looked into her eyes, Great Ellen morphed her face into a hawk's, eyes yellow and severe beneath the sharp slant of feathered brow ridges, a deadly hooked beak where her nose should have been.
"Don't,"
Sarai protested, laughing in spite of herself.
"You know I can't withstand the hawk. Look into my eyes and just try lying."
It was a game from when they were younger. Great Ellen had never tried forcing or commanding them to behave or obey. That would have gone ill, especially when their gifts were still volatile and not fully under their control. She'd used craftier methods like this and gotten a better result. It was, in fact, quite difficult to lie to a hawk.
"That's not fair,"
said Sarai, covering her eyes.
"Can't you just trust me and help me?" "Of course I can. But I ought to know how urgent it is. I've wondered when you'd build up a tolerance."
"When, not if."
"Is it happening?"
Sarai uncovered her eyes and found Great Ellen restored to human form, the excoriating hawk gaze replaced by a piercing but compassionate human one. In answer, she gave her the tiniest of nods, and was grateful when she didn't probe deeper.
"All right, then,"
Great Ellen said, all competence, no fuss.
"An extra half dose in the morning, and I'll tinker with the next batch and see what can be done." "Thank you,"
said Sarai. Her relief must have been audible, because Great Ellen gave her a look that was hawk, even without the transformation. She said with caution,
"It won't work forever, you know, no matter what we do." "Don't worry about me,"
said Sarai, with feigned carelessness. But as she went out to the gallery, she added, in an undertone only she could hear,
"I don't think we have to worry about forever."
She saw Sparrow first, kneeling among her orchids, her face dreamy and her hands full of vines, which were visibly growing, slowly cascading out between her fingers to twine through those already in place and fill in gaps where Mazarthium still showed through. At the table, Minya and Feral were faced off across the quell board, deep in a game. It was evident from Feral's glower that he was losing, while Minya looked half bored and stifled a yawn before moving her piece. Sarai had never been so glad of the predictable monotony of life in the Citadel as she was now. She would even welcome Kimril soup in all its comforting dullness. This evening, however, was to be neither comforting nor dull.
"Poor thing,"
she heard Ruby croon, and, turning to look, saw her standing squarely in front of Ari Isle. Sarai stopped in her tracks. It was jarring, seeing him again after seeing his corpse. Minya had promised to release him, but he was very much still with them. And if he had come to grips with the basic fact of his new existence, that they were alive and he was not, he had in no way softened in his attitude toward them. His confusion was gone, which only left more room in his expression for hostility. Minya had put him in the corner, the way one might lean a broom or umbrella when not using it, and he was, amazingly, still trying to resist her. Or not so amazingly, perhaps. As Sarai watched, he managed, with incredible effort, to slide his foot a few inches, which could only mean that Minya was still toying with him, holding him imperfectly to allow him false hope. Ruby was standing in front of him, demure, for her, in a knee-length black slip. Her hands were clasped behind her back, and one foot curled coyly around the ankle of the other.
"I know it must be an awful shock," she was saying to him. "But you'll see we're not really so bad. What happened before, none of that was us. We're not like our parents."
She reached out to touch his cheek. It was a tender gesture. Ruby was thoughtless, but she wasn't toying with the ghost as Minya was. Sarai knew she meant to be consoling. The dead man was, however, in no mood for consolation.
"Don't touch me, Gutspawn!"
he snarled, and snapped at her like an animal. Ruby snatched it back.
"Rude,"
she said, and turned to Minya.
"You let him do that." "No biting,"
Minya told the ghost, though of course Ruby was right. He wouldn't have been able to do it unless she'd let him. Knowing her, Sarai thought, she probably made him do it. She used them like puppets sometimes. Sarai remembered her nightmare, and having no control over her own knife-wielding hand, and shuddered at the thought of being Minya's toy.
"Minya,"
she said, remonstrating.
"You promised you'd let him go."
Minya's eyebrows shot up.
"Did I? That doesn't sound like me at all."
Nor did it. Minya was many things, perverse, capricious, and obstinate among them. She was like a wild creature, by turns furtive and barging, ever unwashed, and with the staring lack of empathy that belongs to murderers and small children. Attempts at civilizing her rolled right off her. She was invulnerable to praise, reason, and shame, which meant she couldn't be coaxed or persuaded. And she was cunning, which made her hard to trick. She was ungovernable, flawlessly selfish, resentful, and sly. One thing she was not, ever, was obliging.
"Well, you did," Sarai persisted. "So, would you, please?" "What, now? But I'm right in the middle of a game." "I'm sure you'll survive the inconvenience."
Feral had been studying the game board, chin sunk in hand. But he looked up now with just his eyeballs, surprised to hear Sarai arguing with Minya. As a rule, that was something they avoided. But Sarai's anger made her careless. She was in no mood for tiptoeing around the little girl's whims right now. After the dream she'd had, the last thing she needed was another baleful ghost glaring at her.
"What's the matter with you?"
Minya asked.
"I suppose you're bleeding."
It took Sarai a moment to understand what she meant, because she thought of the blood spurting up from the wound in the bed, and of the phantom pressure of the knife point against her breast. But it was her monthly bleeding that Minya meant, and the suggestion only made her angrier.
"No, Minya. Unlike you, the rest of us experience a normal range of emotion, including, but not limited to distress, when forced to endure the disgust of the dead."
And it wasn't Ari Isle's face in her mind when she said it, but the old women all crowded round her, and she knew that at least part of her anger at Minya was left over from the dream and was irrational, because Minya hadn't actually turned old women loose to wander the citadel and attempt to murder her. But part of being irrational is not caring that you're being irrational. And right now, she just didn't.
Is he bothering you so much?
Minya asked.
I can make him face the wall, if it helps.
It doesn't help, said Sarai. Just let him go.
The others were watching, breath all but held, eyes overlarge. Minya's eyes were always large, and now they glittered.
Are you sure?
She asked, and it felt like a trap. But what kind of trap could it possibly be?
Of course I'm sure, said Sarai.
All right,
said Minya in a lilting tone that signified it went against her better judgment.
But it is strange you don't want to hear his news first.
News? Sarai tried to match Minya's feigned calm.
What's news?
First you don't want to hear and now you do.
She rolled her eyes.
Really, Sarai, make up your mind.
I never didn't want to hear,
Sarai snapped.
You never said there was anything to hear.
Touchy,
said Minya.
Are you sure you aren't bleeding?
What would you know about that? Sarai wanted to demand. If you ever decide to grow up, then maybe we'll talk about it. But she wasn't nearly angry enough, or foolish enough, to speak the words grow up to Minya. She just gritted her teeth and waited. Minya turned to Ariel.
Come over here,
she said, and he did, though she still asserted only partial control, allowing him to fight against her at every step, so that he came lurching and stumbling. It was grotesque to watch, which was, of course, the point. She brought him to the opposite end of the long table from where she sat.
Go on, then,
she said.
Tell them what you told me.
Tell them yourself,
he spat. And it wasn't him she was toying with now by dragging out the suspense of it, but the rest of them. Minya paused to study the quell board, taking her time to move one of her game pieces, and Sarai could tell from Feral's expression that it was a devastating move. Minya collected her captured piece with a look of smug satisfaction. A scream was building in Sarai's mind, and, with it, an awful presentiment that the pall of doom of the past day had been leading to this moment.
What news?
It's lucky for us you happened to die,
Minya said, redirecting herself at the ghost.
Else we might have been taken entirely by surprise.
It doesn't matter whether you're surprised, snarled the dead man. He killed you once. He'll do it again.
A jolt went through Sarai. Sparrow gasped. Feral sat bolt upright.
Minya, he said. What is he talking about?
Tell them,
commanded Minya. Her voice was still bright, but not like a bell now, like a knife. She rose to her feet, which were bare and dirty, and stepped from her chair onto the table. She prowled the length of it until she was standing right in front of him. They were nearly eye to eye. He, an imposing grown man. She, a slight and messy child. No more suspense, and no more delusion of freedom. Her will clamped onto him, and his words reeled out as though she'd reached down his throat and ripped them from him.
The Godslayer is coming!
He cried out, gasping. That much Minya made him tell, but the rest he spoke freely, savagely.
And he's going to tear your world apart!
Minya looked over her shoulder. Sarai saw scathes in her eyes, as though the god of beasts were somehow alive in his small daughter. It was a chilling look, cold and accusing, full of blame and triumph.
Well, Sarai,
she asked,
what do you have to say about that? Your papa's come back home.
Chapter 21.
The problem in Weep.
What is that? Laszlo asked.